And when he heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I have not found such faith, not even in Israel." I want to talk this morning about such faith, such great faith. Actually, I'll talk first about the word "such great." It's actually one word in the Greek, and it's an article followed by a little adjective. And in all translations, well, but one, it says "such great faith," because that's probably an appropriate translation. The emphasis on "great," not the "such." And you'll recognize that Greek phrase from other very familiar verses. John 12:37. "But though he had done so many signs," it can mean so many, so long, so great, those kind of, it's just a superlative introduction to whatever the next word is, which is in this case, faith. "But what are five loaves and two fishes among so many people?" John 14:9. "Have I been with you so long, and yet you ask, 'Show us the Father?'" You know, you recognize these verses. Hebrews 12:1. "Seeing we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses." Are you getting the flavor of this? Such great faith. Turn to Matthew chapter 8. And we'll be reading the event from which this quote is taken during the early part of Jesus' ministry in a few minutes. I'll have a little bit of background information before we get into that. I think you should know that this miracle, which is the centurion, the healing of the centurion's servant or slave or boy, these are all three different Greek words used in the text, is recorded twice, once in Matthew 8, right after the Sermon on the Mount, and once in Luke 7, and not in the other accounts. But I want to look at the context because I think it helps us see maybe what the point of both authors, but by inspiration, was for us in recounting this miracle. As I mentioned, it was early in Jesus' ministry, the first year, probably, piecing together both the placing in the books, but also the attitudes of the people and some of the other information. It occurs in Capernaum, and that's where Jesus' center of operations was early on. And it was a time of growing popularity, maybe even surprised that Jesus was doing all these many miracles. In Matthew's account, you remember that Matthew, at the end of chapter 4, beginning actually right before chapters 5 through 7, which is, you know, the Sermon on the Mount. But right before the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew says this in Matthew 4. He says that Jesus went about preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing, and then there's a long list of miracles that he did. So there's this pairing of the teaching of the kingdom, which is the theme of Matthew, the kingdom of heaven, and then the miracles that go along. So now we have chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, followed by a bunch of miracles. And this is the first one, except there's a short one right before this one, which is the healing of the leper. And you remember what's striking about the healing of the leper? You remember the leper came to Jesus and said, "If you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus touched him. An unclean man, an outcast as a leper, and Jesus touched him. In fact, it's interesting that Jesus just said, "I am willing," and then touched him. Stated his willingness to reach out to this man who was unclean. It's just before, that is in Matthew 8, it's just before that incident where Jesus heals Peter's wife's mother. I guess that's a mother-in-law, right? And then following that, just a flood of miracles where people are just bringing them all through the day and, you know, on into the night. And that is actually found in Luke 4 before the miracle is recorded in Luke. And there's some indication that Luke's is more chronologically arranged because in Luke it follows not the Sermon on the Mount, but the Sermon on the Plain. Now, maybe those are the same. Maybe they're not. But again, it follows some intense teaching on Jesus' part. This miracle healing of the centurion's son follows that. And it's right before the first resurrection, that is raising from the dead, that Jesus performed in the city of Nain in Luke's account. But in Luke, it looks like it's somewhat chronological. He ends that. He said, after these things, he entered into the city of Capernaum. And then this story follows from that. I just want to if that's true, if we got the chronology roughly right, I think it will be helpful to see what might have happened in Capernaum up to this point. I think all these things are related to the sermon, but just bear with me. It's interesting details. Maybe we can pull them all together at some point. But we're in the city of Capernaum, which you remember, Jesus had established as kind of his base of operation, especially in the early part of his ministry. And he apparently lived there. Peter, Matthew was called near there. So it was his home base for the early Galilean ministry. And he was teaching and healing in the synagogue earlier in his ministry there. Luke 4 and so on describes the casting out of a demon there. Luke 6:6 is the withered man where there's opposition. I think that event, even though it's before this one in the text, it probably occurred after because of the level of opposition included. That's in 6:6. But 4:3 says that he cast out a demon and people marveled. They were surprised, shocked that he had this kind of power to do that kind of thing. And I think that's background. I want you to remember that it happened in the synagogue in Capernaum. That plays into the story to some extent. And then in Mark 1:21, you may remember that there was a man that was couldn't walk, and they carried him to Jesus and couldn't get in the house and lowered him down through the roof and all that. And that happened also in Capernaum as well. And the crowds were amazed at Jesus' authority and power. I'm sorry, this is the one I meant to mention in Mark chapter 2, where he forgives sins and then heals the paralytic so that they would know he had the authority to forgive sins. And the scribes and Pharisees called it blasphemy. That seems to have occurred before this event. It's recorded earlier in Mark's account, at least. And those that were there marveled and glorified God that he had given power to men. There's another incident that didn't happen in Capernaum, but Capernaum was involved. And that is the second, as John records it, the second sign that Jesus did having come out of Judea. And that's in John chapter 4. And that's the healing of the nobleman's son, not to be confused with a centurion. And it's a son, not a servant. What's interesting is that it's in Cana, but the nobleman lived in Capernaum, and that's where his sick son was. And he had apparently traveled all the way to Cana to find Jesus. And these two miracles are sometimes confused, but I just want to highlight for a second the difference between them. First of all, Jesus was at Cana, not Capernaum. You can see that in John 4. Even though the son, at a distance, was in Capernaum. The nobleman came himself, and we're going to see in this story from Luke's account that in this case the centurion maybe never even spoke to Jesus through this whole story. Jesus rebukes the lack of faith. His first reaction is, oh, what a generation this is. You won't believe unless there's signs. That is not the reaction Jesus had, as you saw earlier, to the way the centurion approached him. And the other thing is, the nobleman twice demanded Jesus come. Please come and heal my servant. And that's the exact opposite of what the centurion said. He said, you don't need to come. We'll cover that in just a minute, but it's a very different incident. And then Jesus said, I'm not, but your son is well. And that became a test of the man's faith. And he believed, John said, and he went home and the son was healed. So very similar, but enough differences that it's probably not the same incident. However, probably occurred prior to this story. And I wonder, given that the nobleman was from Capernaum, if a centurion in charge of things in Capernaum might have heard about that story. And the crippled man that was laid down through the roof. And the healing of the exorcism that occurred in the synagogue where people marveled. Do you think the centurion in that city of Capernaum might have known of those miracles that seem to have occurred before this story? A little bit about centurions. This probably won't surprise you, but they were kind of in charge of 100 men, but really not. Often it was less than that. And I suppose in most armies, there's never quite the full, platoon size or whatever, but often the centurion's century, as it's called, was maybe only 60 to 80 men. And there were different centuries of various size and rank, even the centuries themselves. And so the first century might be the very top-ranked folks in the whole cohort, for example. And if you put six centuries together, you'd get a cohort, and so on. And that all made up the Roman legion. So that's kind of the way the army was structured. And I was surprised, because I just wanted to see, how are centurions generally represented in the New Testament? And it's all good. This is surprising to me. And there's way more than I knew, actually. you know, you remember the centurion at the cross. Surely this is the Son of God, he said, after having seen the events surrounding the crucifixion. You remember a man named Cornelius, right? In Acts chapter 10, we'll look at him in a little more detail in just a second. But he was devout. He feared God. He gave alms. He prayed. That's the way he's introduced. There was a centurion that rescued Paul from the beating that was about to occur in Jerusalem once Paul came back at the end of the third journey. Remember that? Kind of almost jerked him out from among the Jews who had their whips ready to beat him. And there's another one that actually, as a result of being tipped off by, I think, a relative of Paul, helped Paul escape from Capernaum, from Jerusalem, and get up to Caesarea so he could escape the plot of the Jews to kill him. And then I found this guy, he's named, his name is Julius, and I think it might deserve a character study. He's introduced in chapter 27, but he is kind of Paul's guard escort to Rome, and he goes with Paul, and they have interactions, and he first disagrees with some guidance Paul gives, and later, when the shipwreck's coming, the centurion enters into the story and defends Paul. It's amazing what this guy did, carrying Paul and delivered him all the way to Rome for that first imprisonment. Go look that guy up. That's an interesting. We know his name, too. I wonder if that's because he may have been converted at some point later. I don't know. Well, I would just say centurions are mainly good men. And this is not necessarily relevant to the lesson, but it's been my experience at working in an industry where we do a lot of work with military people, that men who have achieved the rank where they are in charge of, 100 or more men, have achieved that because they're good at motivating. They're high-integrity individuals. They understand that the performance of their troop, they're responsible for the discipline and the care and feeding and promotion careers of the men under them. They understand the value of treating people correctly, and they often are men of high integrity. This is in my opinion in the military. And I think this is a level. Now, get on up to the political appointees, run away, okay? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the men who have risen in the ranks to command a certain number of men. These are generally, it seems to me, are good quality, good character. And we're going to see that in this story as well. To be a centurion, you had to be 30 years old or older. You had to be able to read and write. You had to be recommended by someone in your acquaintance, usually someone who would have influence in the Roman government. You had to have some military experience. And if you were a man of valor, then you could be nominated earlier than maybe it would take. So this sounds familiar, probably, as in any military system. They had to be a Roman citizen, or they were Roman citizens as a result of their service. They received higher pay than the men under them by a good bit. In fact, the men under them were often mercenaries, and the Romans didn't have enough armies to, guard all the lands that they had conquered, and so they would hire locals or hire mercenaries, but they'd always have a Roman citizen, kind of, especially in an area that was troublesome or had difficulty keeping the peace. They would have a centurion, but he might have men under him that were not Roman citizens, but he was. And they were usually of high social standing in the community. They were leaders in the community where they were. And when they retired, they could expect government employment, maybe by someone in the government, Roman government, if they'd served well. The interesting thing I found is they had often had, I mentioned that, but they often had veteran soldiers who had served faithfully, during their command. And then when those veterans kind of retired, they just became servants in the household of the centurion. That may explain why this particular servant was dear to the man. I don't know. I think in our minds we think, well, it's a young man, but I don't know that that's necessary from the Greek. It could have been a loyal servant, soldier, retired servant, that was sick in this story. So those are all details I think that give a little bit more life to the story. Now, I borrowed this chart from Bill Sanchez. Okay. So, but I just want to highlight that there are two accounts, one in Matthew and one in Luke, that tell different parts of the story. And I've put in yellow on the left the parts in Matthew that are not mentioned in Luke, and the parts in Luke that are not mentioned in Matthew, I put in blue. You see that? So just a kind of a cartoon of how these two stories, it's clearly the same story, but they weave together so beautifully. And you can see the value of the two accounts there. I guess I should address at this point the most obvious difference between the two, because I think it causes some people some trouble. And it may be why this miracle is not preached on very much, because there's a key difference. In Matthew's account, there's no mention of the intermediaries. There are two sets of intermediaries, the Jewish elders and then some friends of the centurion who come. And Matthew is written in a shorter form, really, as if the man came to Jesus himself and the interaction is directly with Jesus. Luke, however, fills in the detail that in both of the interactions, and Luke breaks them into two, the man had sent Jewish elders in his place. He even explains why in verse 7. He says, "I'm not worthy to come to you." And he also in another place says, "And I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof." It was the humility of this man, realizing as a Gentile the trouble he might cause Jesus, coming directly and having come. That's what kept him from coming. Both accounts talk about him saying not being worthy, but I think it's pretty clear. And even Luke itself kind of hints that Jesus is almost interacting directly with this man through these intermediaries. When he says, "And Jesus marveled at him." Well, how could he do that? He had never seen him. Well, because he heard him. He heard his voice. He heard his words. And so both accounts, I think, fit together very well. Matthew's emphasis, as you can see from the yellow there, is getting to a prophecy about a coming kingdom. Imagine that in Matthew, something about the kingdom of heaven, right? And that's where Matthew's headed with this. Luke, it seems, maybe emphasizing more his outcast status and some other things which Jesus overcomes. But in any case, it's the same incident. But I want to read both of them this morning. And with all that background about Capernaum, about centurions and other things, let's read those. And we'll start with Matthew's account. Matthew 8, verse 5. "When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented.' And Jesus said to him, 'I will come, I will come and heal him.'" Does that somewhat remind you of "I am willing," which happened right before this in Matthew? The leper says, "If you're willing," he says, "I will come. I will come and heal him." "The centurion answered and said, 'Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it.' When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, 'Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.' And then Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go your way. And as you have believed, so let it be done for you.' And his servant was healed that same hour." Luke 7, verse 1. "Now when he had concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear to him, was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving. For he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with him. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, 'Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. And therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it.' When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, 'I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel.' And those who were sent, returning to the house, found the servant well who had been sick." You see, these are clearly the same stories, but it's great the details that get added in there between the two. So let's combine the story quickly and just tell it, maybe trying to put all the events and some of the details, a little commentary as we go, and then I'll make three points of application about what a great faith is. He's called a servant, a boy, and a slave. The word boy not necessarily meaning young, but someone under the service. It was not his son. Luke adds that he was dear to this man. He loved him. And apparently a man of generosity and kindness in many ways. The servant was sick and ready to die, according to Luke, the physician, right? Matthew adds that he was paralyzed and also dreadfully tormented, probably meaning in great pain. And I have to contrast that to the other miracle in Mark 2, where the man was able to be moved, carried on a stretcher, lifted up on a roof, dropped down into the house and all that. That was not going to happen here. This man was close to death, and whatever his disease was, he was so much in pain that he couldn't even move and was ready to die, according to Luke. So the centurion enlists the elders, and I'm trying to follow the same color scheme, okay? Blue is Luke and yellow is Matthew. The centurion enlists the elders to go to Jesus, and he explains why in Luke chapter 7, verse 7. He says, because I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you, is the message he sent to Jesus. Now, I am interested, but I will never know, I don't guess, what these Jewish elders thought about that. Now, it's not the scribes and Pharisees. Did they feel like this guy is so good, we're going to help him? Or did they feel a sense of obligation? Well, he paid for our synagogue. Maybe we should help him, you know, because we're kind of dependent on him as a benefactor, right? Or did they say, well, he's a Roman soldier. He's making us do this. I guess we can't. I don't like it, but we're going to have to do it, you know. I don't want to invite Jesus, this great rabbi, to go to the house of a Gentile. So I wonder if they were conflicted. I don't know. Just a thought to have about that as we kind of go through the story. But their request was, come and heal him. Matthew doesn't record the man himself saying come. But the friends apparently said come and heal. But it's pretty clear they didn't mean to say, and the man for sure didn't mean them to say, come to my house. Maybe he meant come toward this area or come close enough or something. But in any case, another detail is found in Luke is that Jewish elders testify to the fact that this man is worthy. He's deserving. You should do this for him because of the works he's done, right? He loves our he built our synagogue. You know, he's not a full proselyte, you know, in the sense that he's accepted into fellowship or anything like that. But he's just a good man, kind of like is recorded about Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. In Matthew's account, Jesus said, I will come and heal him. We pointed that out. And in Luke's account, it just says he went with them as they started off toward the man's house, apparently. And very similar to the leper statement. When they were not far from the house, according to Luke, apparently the centurion, this is a little bit of a speculation, but he heard, he's coming to my house. And he apparently grabbed some friends nearby and he sent them out to stop him. He never intended for Jesus to come to his house. He didn't even want to go to Jesus himself. And so he sent the friends to stop him and made the speech about, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. And then he talks about authority. And he says, look, I know how this works. I have people that I report to, and when they tell me to do something, I do it, and I have men the same way under me. And he said, you have authority to do this, and that's in both accounts. And I think you just say the word, just like I say the word, and they do it. And I think you have the power to do this, and you don't need to, you know. In fact, he said, I didn't want to trouble you, as if there would be some inconvenience. Probably would be an inconvenience in Jesus' life to come there. In fact, I may mention this later, but you know that for a Jew, well, I'll say this point to a little bit later, but you understand Jews going to Gentiles' houses was not a good thing. And Jesus would have been put under some degree of difficulty if he did that. And Jesus responds with, I've not found such great faith, not even in Israel. And then, in Matthew's account only, Jesus prophesies of a feast for all nations. And I'll point out when we get to the 3 points about great faith that in each case, Jesus gives the man a response. And I think in some ways greater than he expected in each case. But we'll see that. But one of the things he does is he quotes, I think, or makes a reference, an allusion for sure, to a passage in Isaiah that describes a great feast coming. And you might wonder, but probably can figure out, why this feast has to do with all nations being invited. What would that have to do with this story? All nations being invited. And so, at that point, after the mention of that, Jesus said, go your way. And it's, as you have believed, so let it be done. I like the way he phrases that. And then at the end, of course, the servants go back in Luke's account and they find that the friends go back and they find that the servant had been healed at the very moment Jesus had said that. So that's the story. What is great faith? Can we learn from this centurion? I think we're supposed to learn from this centurion. In fact, Jesus turns to the Jewish people and said, I'm not finding this kind of faith even in Israel. And I ought to be, but I'm not. And so somehow this is an example to them and surely to us as well to find out what is such great faith. And I'm going to suggest briefly, really, there are three things about this man that indicates such great faith. And I think it's relevant. You can disagree with me, but I really do think for our time it's relevant. He was not deterred by his, and I couldn't find a good word for this, so I made one up, outsiderness. Can you understand what I mean by that? He was on the outside looking in as a Gentile. And even Jesus says, I haven't found such great faith where? Not in Israel, which means this man, where is he? He is not in Israel. He's not Jewish. He's not one of God's chosen people, to use the language of Moses. And it's interesting that this man, I'm calling it, he's not deterred by worldly outsiders. First thing he did is he didn't say, you know, I'm a centurion. I'm educated, rich. I'm under the power of the Roman Empire. I have done good things. I've built it. I'm a generous person. I'm here on behalf of someone else, right? And so he's saying, I deserve better than this. I deserve to be accepted. Can you imagine in our society, someone coming up and maybe to our building, and we say, you're not welcome here. You got the wrong color. You got the wrong nation. You got the wrong religion. You got the wrong heritage. Can you imagine that in our culture? What would happen? We'd have the media here in just a few minutes, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, I didn't think of this in time to put it on the chart, and it'll probably come up out of order, but it just fits right here. I want you to listen to what Peter tells Cornelius, another centurion at a nearby town, Caesarea, in Acts chapter 10. Peter, you know, Cornelius falls down to worship him. And Peter said, get up, I'm just a man. Verse 28 of chapter 10. You know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or go to one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. What does that imply? Peter was calling Gentiles common or unclean. Can you imagine we are so into being accepted and everybody being equal. And I'm telling you, the world is not that way. And I'm not condoning this kind of exclusivism, but I'm saying this man was in the heart of it. He was common and unclean. He knew that Jesus, this great Messiah, couldn't come to his house by law, by tradition more, right? Now, did he get angry? Did he demand his rights? Did he protest? Did he appeal to Jesus to fix this social system? No, he just said, don't come to my house. I don't want to trouble you. Why was that? Why did he do that? Why did he ignore this kind of apparent injustice? Why did he do that? Is it possible that he was in search of something way more important to him than that? Not that Jesus condones any of that kind of thing, but still, this man ignored all that. Have you ever heard the objection? Well, that church down there is so closed-minded, or it's a white man's religion. Interesting inversion here. The only Western European in this story is the centurion, right? And you hear this kind of silly talk about, you know, Christianity is a white man's religion. That kind of, wait a minute, wait. There's the only white man in this story, I don't know their color skin, and I hope not to be, is this Roman guy. I'm assuming he might have been from Rome, but in any case, it's an upside down story here, the way it works out. My point is not to justify any of the behavior of the society at that time, but to say it didn't bother this guy because he had a bigger mission in his head. And that was to get to the Savior and get this blessing that he wanted. That's such great faith. It doesn't matter whether you're accepted in the world, what the world thinks of you. Isn't that part of the message of Christianity? That there's something way bigger that we're all searching for? He didn't demand that. He was concerned, in fact, almost to the other extreme, to not put Jesus in a difficult situation. As unjust as this is, Jesus, I don't want to trouble the teachers, what he said. And of course, related to these other passages, I don't want you to get in trouble. And by the way, did Jesus ever get in trouble for whom he ate with? Actually, already, in this very, I think Mark's account maybe, Jesus had already been, no, I think it's Luke's account, had already been criticized for eating with tax collectors and sinners. He had already been, so that was important in Jesus' ministry. And the other thing is, Jesus really didn't deny his outsiderness. In fact, in some ways, he validated. He's not in Israel, but that didn't matter. He has great faith. That's kind of what he said. And then I think the parable, and the reason I think this particular conflict or this issue in the story is really to be seen, is really to be highlighted in the understanding of it, is in Matthew's account, Jesus turns to the Jews and he says, you know what? There's a day coming when God's going to make a feast, a wonderful feast, and everyone from the east and the west. Interesting in Matthew that early on the Magi come from the east, right? Well, here's a centurion from the west. And so here's east and west, neither Jewish. They'll sit at feast in the kingdom with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the great patriarchs of the Jewish nation. And I think to understand that fully, we need to understand where that feast is referenced. I read somewhere that the Jewish people's idea of what the feast was Psalm 23, where David says, "Thou preparest a table in the presence of mine enemies," meaning we get the feast and our enemies are kept out. That was their sense of it, you know, just for Jews. But that's not what Isaiah said. Look at Isaiah 24. After describing a kind of a destruction of the world and a disassembling of the order of things, very frightening picture in chapter 24. In chapter 25, Isaiah paints a positive picture of the replacement of that destruction with God's kingdom. And he says, "For the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his elders gloriously. And in this mountain," skipping to 25 verse 6, "the Lord of hosts," or Yahweh of hosts, of the armies, "will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wine on the lees. And he will destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that is spread over all nations." Now, you see that all people and all nations is the emphasis of this, especially when you paint it in yellow and make it bold. But the point is, he's saying all people. And it's not just that they're all invited to this wonderful feast, but he's actually lifting the veil, probably of ignorance or unenlightenment or unacceptability or something, that's just, it's cast over the whole world, but now it's lifted up. The whole world is available and invited to come to this great feast that spread over all the nations. That's what the Jewish hearers, and I suspect the man himself was familiar enough, having built the synagogue, I hope he attended some and listened to the reading of the scrolls that were done there, that he understood Jesus is referring to this very passage in Isaiah about all people being welcome. That's Jesus' answer to the thing. Not, "We'll fix it now so you get accepted into all the homes of the Jews and they'll come visit you and you get equal rights and we'll make reparations for everything." That wasn't Jesus' answer. He said, no, there's a day coming when every nation is invited equally to a much greater feast and much greater blessings. And so in a way, Jesus answers him with a greater promise. A second element of such great faith is that he acknowledged his own unworthiness. It's funny that the Jewish elders, or ironic maybe, I don't know, that the Jewish elders said, "He's deserving. You know, he's worked his way where you ought to heal his servant for him because he built our synagogue and he loves our nation." Obviously, that's the right nation to love, right, in their view. They had a kind of a works-based view of things, and that was their defense of this man before Jesus and why, although he's a Gentile, you probably could go ahead and do this for him because he's just a good guy. But this man, twice in Luke, confesses, "I'm not even worthy to come to you. I'm not worthy to have you under my roof." And all that despite his wealth, his authority, his accomplishments as a centurion, his leadership status in the community. And he says, "I'm not worthy," despite these works that the Jewish people mentioned. Boy, in our culture, isn't that countercultural? We are all into, self-worth is the foundation of everything. You can't think straight unless you appreciate what you are. I think this great faith says, no, you can't think straight unless you appreciate what you are, what you really are, which all of us are undeserving. And if we have any kind of conscience and any kind of memory, we know that we are not worthy to come to Jesus, that we come to Him, or that He just gets invited to our house on the basis of our own merits and works. This is great faith that the centurion illustrates. It's interesting, Jesus didn't say, oh no, you're a good guy. Hey, don't beat yourself up. You know, that's not the reaction. He just goes on with the story and gives the man the blessing, as you have believed. He didn't deny that, and he actually didn't go enter his house to somehow prove a point in the society and all that kind of thing. But he did grant his request, despite the centurion's self-confessed unworthiness. That's where we are. And you understand, if you go back in Matthew, read the previous three chapters, the Sermon on the Mount, and what does Jesus require of those that are poor in spirit and other things? He doesn't want people who think that's the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. You know, this is part of the story that he's telling here about the centurion. And then I think the third element of this, and there's probably 17 elements, but these are the three I could think of about what such great faith is that he appreciated, understood, and I use the term apprehended, meaning he could see the size and scope of Jesus' authority and power. And that's been a theme in both of the accounts, both of the gospel accounts up to this point. He taught as one having authority. He illustrated power over, blah, blah. So those are common themes, but he just apprehended that Jesus had authority over things like diseases. And he wasn't limited in his power by space or time or circumstance or how deadly the disease was or how close to death the man was and so on. He didn't ever come to doubt. In fact, it's clear he just said, you don't need to come. You don't need to come. Contrast to the nobleman who came and twice said, no, come to my house. And Jesus said, well, you know, he's healed. Oh, no, come to my house. And you find him actually twice asking for that. And I think he deduced that perhaps from his own understanding of authority. Not perhaps he says that. He says, I know how authority works. But I think, too, he has seen the teaching in miracles in Capernaum, in the synagogue, in that house where the man came down through the roof, to know that Jesus heals people in amazing and instant ways and has great power. And from that, he reasoned, I think reasoned correctly, that Jesus could do it. And he didn't see any limits. Just say the word. Say the word, and that will happen. And so, interestingly enough, and this is kind of by implication, again, looking at that prophecy in Isaiah, Jesus kind of, in a way, reveals a greater power, which shouldn't have been hard for this man to understand. But if you go back again to that passage we read a minute ago about the feast, in fact, I'll show you here. I meant to say this first. When Jesus said, they'll come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. Does that sound familiar, this reference to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as being alive and being in a feast? Do you remember that ever coming up again later in Jesus' ministry? Well, in Matthew 22, they asked Jesus really about the resurrection essentially. And Jesus says, well, did you not ever read in the burning bush passage, I think Luke calls it that I am the God of Abraham. You remember that? Abraham... The fact that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are waiting around for this feast, I guess, if you want to think of it in earthly time terms, means they're alive. There's a resurrection. And he's implying in that there's not only all nations invited, but also there'll be this resurrection. And Abraham, the great patriarchs, will be part of that great feast that Isaiah prophesied. And so let's go to Isaiah 25 again. We just read this about the feast. And on the mountain, the surface of all cast is destroyed. The veil is taken away. The very next verse, what does he say in Isaiah 25? He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces. And the rebuke of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. We're all experts on 1 Corinthians now, aren't we? Do you recognize he will swallow up death forever? 1 Corinthians 15. I mean, Paul quotes that as an indication that there is a resurrection from the dead. And it's almost as if, in recognizing Jesus' power over distance and just say the word, and Jesus responds, oh, it's more than that. It's bigger than that. All nations will be brought together, and the great patriarchs will be there. And there'll be no more tears. and death is gone forever. And you won't have to worry about a servant that's nearly about to die anymore. And that's the message that these friends, I think, carry back to this man. It's interesting, isn't it, that this great faith, in a sense, produces greater things than the faith itself might have expected in each of these responses. Such great faith. I'm going to review. Because he was not deterred by his social exclusion in this world, which we learn doesn't matter. I hope we learn that. He was invited to a heavenly feast. You talk about inclusion. Where do we want to be included? Because he acknowledged his own unworthiness, he was granted. He was given what he wanted most, what he asked Jesus for. And because he confessed Jesus' power and authority without limits, he was shown Jesus' power over the last enemy, which is death. Especially in the context. Interesting, in Luke's account, what is the next miracle? It's the first raising of someone from the dead in the widow of Nain's son. Do you see in this that there's another passage that I just couldn't help coming to mind, and it's in Luke's account of the parable of the sower. And, you know, Jesus ends that by saying this, Therefore, take heed how you hear. Are we listening with great faith, using the example of this man? For whoever has, to him more will be given. Whoever does not have, even what he seems to have will be taken from him. You see that in this story? This man had great faith. Did he get more than he asked for? More than he expected? Oh, yes. In Jesus' response to him in that way. But he must stand as an example to us. And so I ask you this morning, are you being deterred by some social forces that really should be seen as not even significant compared to the ability to participate in the great feast that's coming? Something that's holding you back, approval of friends, disapproval of family, whatever it is. Are you acknowledging your own unworthiness? Because, you know, if you don't do that, you don't feel any need for the gospel, for Jesus' message. You don't have any sense. It's interesting, these people like the nobleman even and the centurion and others are driven to the leper, are driven to Jesus by a sense of need. If we don't have that sense of need, we will not be driven to him. And it's the foundation of such great faith. And finally, we have in this acceptance of Jesus' power and authority, demonstrated by his own resurrection, by the way, as the first fruits, we have an illustration that this obedience out of such great faith brings to us the hope of eternal life. And it's in this story that happens. We'd invite you to come. The first step is believing and confessing this faith in Jesus and his power, repenting of the sins that create the unworthiness on our part, and then being baptized, sharing indeed Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection at the point at which the Bible says your sins are washed away. If we can help you do that or anything else that's needed that you need to express in a public way, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing.